Business Disability Forum, creating a disability smart world together.
Hello and welcome to the second series of our podcast series, If You Don't Mind Me Asking, where we ask questions and explore the lived experiences of people with disabilities. I'm here with my co-host Lucy and I'm Dan, and we still both work at Business Disability Forum.
And it's a pleasure to be back with another conversation. And today we're delighted to be joined by Peter Torres Fremlin. So, Peter, if you could just tell us a bit about yourself, who you are, where you come from, what you do. I know that's like five questions in one, but go ahead with that intro if you could, please, Peter.
Hi, Lucy. Hi, Dan. Great to be with you guys. I'm a disabled guy. I'm British. I grew up here. And then I did my work abroad. I was working in international development in Bangladesh, and then I was based after that in Egypt, learning Arabic. Obviously, the pandemic changed lots of things for many of us. It brought me back to this country quite quickly. And from there, I carry on my work, sort of it's with an international focus on disability. And now my main thing is writing Disability Debrief, which is a newsletter with international news on disability from around the world.
Wonderful. We'll certainly get on to the debrief, Peter. But as specifically on sort of so your working abroad, what really drove that aspect of like getting away from the UK, exploring? What drove you to go?
Well, you summarized part of it. Right there, Dan. I always loved travel. It was very kind of central in my family. And then, so during university, I was kind of going on holidays. And part of that also, I'll be honest, is kind of like a kind of test myself factor on the disability drama. I sort of, at that stage, I walked slowly, had difficulty climbing stairs. I didn't know if I could go by myself to places like Morocco and China and Bangladesh. And so I was like, well, we got to find out. So I did. And I went and then really, really fell in love with it. A huge part for me is the language and the culture and getting to know people. So it was always language learning in the places that I was. And then I got into the disability scene, like actually I'd been realizing a bit more about sort of my own identity as a disabled person and seeing that a bit more in a political way and whatnot on my own, but it was quite on my own. I didn't sort of have social contact with disabled people like in those terms, right? Obviously there's we all know disabled people in our lives and families and friends, right? But in Bangladesh I met a group of disabled people and they brought me in. They were doing little meetings and really sort of changing people's lives in sort of really extraordinary way by just exposing like people with disabilities and their families and the communities to like it can be different. And I mean, listeners will notice that I'm saying people with disabilities, not disabled people. I use them interchangeably, but obviously like in the UK, we sometimes get a bit excited about sort of focusing on disabled people, but I use them interchangeably.
Good stuff. And I was wondering what drew you to that work in employment? You're talking about your work in Bangladesh and meeting with people and that kind of, it's almost like a disability family then, I think, sometimes with these things, isn't it? So what drove you to that employment side of things?
Yeah, so that's the focus that I had for many years. And Lucy, that was just absolute luck and opportunism. I needed a job. I'd started working, so it was in international development. Worked in poverty reduction, then worked in disability NGO. And then something called the International Labour Organization wanted to make a strategy to include disabled people in skills programs for like to support the Bangladesh as a country to have that strategy. And I was like, well, labour rights sound a bit boring. But then Lucy, I think as you know, and as colleagues at BDF will really know, like labor right? I mean, they do sound boring, but they're such an important part of our lives. Work really contributes to who we are, what we can become, to social meaning. It's not the only pathways to do those things. But I then saw like this this aspect of, say, when whether people can find their first job, where they can get the skills to do that, is so bound up with who they are and what they can become in the world. So I kind of got into it by accident, but then it really resonated, and I kind of continued with it. And I'm very sort of passionate about it, because if you think about our employment conditions, we're spending so much of our life there, and they're so determining of everything else, and there's so much unfairness, and that kind of motivates me as well, whether it's a manager being sort of unpleasant or restricting someone, or an employer not creating the opportunities they could. So I find that quite motivating to keep me in it for many years.
Massively. I suppose with the global aspect even more so, because I mean, we can easily get wrapped up in our own bubble of, you know, what's going on in the UK before we even start to think about, you know, in different countries and different ways that either disabled people or people with disabilities are appreciated or brought into work. And I know it was when you actually came back to the UK that you started the disability debrief, which again has that global lens. I thought it'd be great if you could just tell us a little bit more about the debrief, how it came about, but also, you know, what is it now? How has it developed?
Thanks, Dan. So I was working with UN organizations and international disability charities. And it's a period in the last few years that work has really grown, right? There was a UN convention, like 2006, 7, 8, roughly. And countries have really widely adopted that. And listeners will be interested to know that actually, a bit over 5 years ago, the British government helped raise disability more internationally, which is quite interesting, obviously, for disabled people living in this country, because you wouldn't sort of characterize the last 10 years as the government sort of focusing and expanding on disability. But they did do it internationally, and that really helped that growing wave of attention to disability issues. So long story short, there was too much information, and I was a bit overwhelmed by it. So I started getting it together and compiling it and sharing it with colleagues. And that's what the debrief started as. And then it sort of became this observatory to look at, sort of gather as much news from as many countries as I could. I think just even in the past year or two, I found news from over 125 countries. And to see like the common struggles, the solutions, like what disabled people are doing and the kind of extraordinary things that are going on. And then it showed me the gaps, right? Like it showed me that there are lots of contexts that we're not hearing about disabled people from, that we're not getting voices, that we're not getting stories. Give a piece just last month, there was this horrible conflict unfolding in Sudan, and like mainstream media and disability organizations were not looking like how disabled people are affected in that. So I did some original reporting on that to cover it. And that's what the disability debrief has now become, sort of a platform for those kind of things. Readers have given me sort of so much support, and they've invested in it, and that lets me do it. So I call it writing in community, because it's kind of me writing. It's for colleagues and friends and the curious and whatnot, and they have invested in that, whether sharing information or financially, or just sharing it, like helping other people know about it. And it's such an honor to be able to kind of celebrate the work being done, and to kind of bear witness to the challenges that are still there, and find new stories to tell about disability.
It's not just the stories you talk about, it's the way you tell the stories or the different ways of getting that media across, isn't it, as well? You know, we're all individuals and we all like stuff in slightly different ways. Can you tell us a little bit about why you focused on that as well, or the variety of things and formats you've used?
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you, Lucy. Is that I've been trying to sort of innovate, I think, partly just like people need information in different ways. But also I think disability means we have to tell the story a little bit differently. Disability means that the sort of overall stories that kind of generalize don't really work. We need to really root it in personal experience. So first I root it in my personal experience, because that when we do that, we see like some of our advocacy lines have generalized things a bit and it doesn't quite fit. When we do that, we see some of the policy positions we've taken like haven't really humanized disabled people and what our struggles are. And so I really root it in my own experience as a way to understand other people's experiences. And when I get other contributors, I really encourage them to like speak to where they are writing from, whether that's a contributor wrote from Peru about the political protests there, or a contributor is writing from New Zealand about climate crisis, and it's very much in their realities. So we kind of, yeah, we're innovating in that. I think that format of the newsletter as well is kind of, and this new generation of digital media is using that format a lot. It kind of fits in a world that we're trying to sort of shift away from social media, or we're in a bit of tense relationship with that. So people are relieved to find that. And another big shift for me was I didn't think this was possible. I thought that like to make people interested in disability, you had to really make it simple and like get rid of all the nuance and just really stick to these simple messages. And in lots of places you do, just to get it across, and like people aren't necessarily always receptive of that. But there's a big appetite for a more complex story with those different sides. There's a big appetite if you think about sort of the way we talk about identity politics. There's a lot of conflict on the talking points around those issues, but there is also an appetite for people to know, like, well, how is this movement trying to change the world? Like, what was working and what wasn't working? And there's always the appetite for the human story, right? And I think that's we also need to celebrate, like, I mean, like, to see people all over the world doing extraordinary things that you just wouldn't, like, you wouldn't believe until, like, you kind of see, until you see what's going on, and the sort of art and the cultural productions that are coming out, that's in TV or writing or whatever form, are just really, really breathtaking. And the advocacy people do in really difficult conditions is stunning. So there's a lot to celebrate that. And I want to sort of find ways to do that range of things, as well as, like I said, sort of witnessing and testifying to the struggles going on.
Yeah, that's why the big things for me, I think, Peter, seeing the variety of different things that you bring in, like you said, the cultural aspects, the art, sort of like their sort of long form interviews and sometimes storytelling, all of these different aspects, and that variety helps to make it relatable, because we are all dealing in sort of things with different ways and the way we take that information in. And so it's fantastic to have that variety, and you have different things that you can become so attached to. And it's funny, because when I think about the time that you spent abroad, working abroad as well, and your experiences there as a disabled person, you touched on this earlier, but having that experience of working abroad, being in touch with different cultures and different parts of society, I just wondered how that affected you, your development, and how you saw yourself and your disability.
Yeah, that's hard to sum up, because I went abroad as soon as I graduated. I studied my master's in Brazil, then started work in Bangladesh, and Bangladesh is real sort of formation for me in many ways, professionally and personally, and what I think the world can be. And it really kind of, yeah, it really sort of helped me how to say, like it put me in contact with lots of different conditions that showed me, like, the many sort of situations disabled people can be in. And, like, in a broad brush, you see kind of similar factors, like attitudes and accessibility, and those are in play anyway. But the specifics of the challenges and the solutions are very different everywhere. So I really felt that personally, the way people would react to me in different places, sort of like walking with difficulty around the place, or when I needed assistance, I would sort of test this out live by falling over in public places and seeing what happened, right? Like, and in many countries, people just run to help in a way that people are a bit shyer about here, and actually shocks my South American friends when they come to this country or come to Europe in general, and that someone needs something on the street and no one's doing anything. Obviously, like, people's relationships with family and the community are then very different. But these solutions that you can find, even in, like, physically extremely inaccessible environments, even in environments where there is, like, very little financial resources, that's been, like, a really enduring lesson for me, because often we associate social progress with material progress. And, like, you can't wait for the material progress, for the social progress. And you don't have to. Like, there is all sorts of creative solutions that can be made with the resources that exist. Obviously, like, those forms of material conditions are still very much needed and pursued, but you don't need to, like, you don't need to wait to install an elevator to be inclusive. Right? Like, you don't, but lots of people kind of associate it like that, and it becomes a block of, like, oh, I don't have the money to make this investment, therefore I'm not going to do anything at all, right?
But it's interesting, it's almost the attitudinal stuff, and I can never say that word properly, but, you know, it is that attitude rather than the materialistic stuff. Actually, if we've got the right attitude to disability and we want to support without interfering, do you know what I mean? Because there is a balance sometimes. It's like you hear these stories of people being led across the street when they didn't want to go and stuff like that. But, you know, if we just communicate and talk as human beings, then the other stuff, yes, of course, we do need to remove those barriers. But actually, the attitude is so important in this, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think you said it sort of exactly right, that like, exclusion comes from, like, sort of a chain of decisions. So interrupting that chain can really sort of flip it, and then rather than, like, everyone ganging up to exclude someone, they kind of gang up to include them. That's very evident, say, in Bangladesh, when sort of seeing extended families that, like, it wasn't exactly flipping a switch, but it did sometimes feel like that sort of, like, oh, the family isn't using the resources to support the inclusion of that person, and then, like, with change, they can be. And I think that works more widely in terms of those choices that we make, and sort of so sort of fundamental to, like, yeah, seeing people as human beings and their value, and responding to the contrary, responding to whatever contribution and communication they're making, and sort of building on that to find something meaningful for them in their lives.
And I find that really interesting, that point around, it's such a stark one about, again, the people here almost sometimes being stopped from helping because of a cultural or societal sort of not wanting to do the wrong thing, when clearly not helping someone up is probably the wrong thing, but because there's so many different decisions to make and what I should be doing. And I think we sometimes, you know, we see that in different ways around where you might think of, oh, the most mature place, which has got lots of, whether it's policy or legislation, but then it's actually about the attitudes. And again, I think that takes it back to the debrief as well, really, okay, the different sort of voices, and now you actually get that.
An example of what you're saying, Dan, when the pandemic started, I was in Egypt, and it was quite interesting to see from afar the UK in the pandemic suddenly like discovered community support, right? Suddenly like there was a lot more attention to that, and neighbors looking out for each other, and neighbors like even finding out who each other were and whatnot. In Egypt, that was where I was living, that like in many extents was just taken for granted. Mm-hmm. They didn't assume it would be the state that helped them in case of need, right? They assumed that they would have, there's obviously big generalizations, they assumed they would have help from their families and their neighbors. So that's quite a big difference. I don't know. I don't know, like, whether in the UK we will kind of keep those keep those lessons. But say when I was recently writing about sort of care and new ways that we are imagining sort of forms of care and assistance, and that kind of community support has to be part of the solution. It can't be the only part, but we're currently in this tension that we're kind of waiting for things from the government, and the government is like not giving it, and it's a bit broken. Like, we need to activate different forms of resources we have. I don't mean abandoning it to the community. I don't mean the government withdrawing. Like, I mean those things kind of working together. And I would sort of say the same, like, in Egypt, they've got this amazing kind of community support. Like, how can the government support that, which currently you wouldn't really say that it was on social issues.
And obviously with the debrief, you're looking at it very much with a global lens. I mean, wonder what you see as the most prevalent trends and challenges globally. What are the common themes that you're seeing coming through on that?
Yeah, I think that we haven't looked enough globally at sort of how the current cost of living crisis is affecting disabled people. I think in this country, we know all too well how like cost of living and then austerity measures and whatnot can really damage the chances of disabled people. So I think that's a tension everywhere. Technology is also a really big one. Like, it's changed so many opportunities for people. And there's a trend that people in the UK will definitely recognize, how to put this, like whitewashing, right? Like, now it is much more fashionable everywhere to say the correct thing about disability, right? It's much more fashionable for government to say that. It's much more fashionable to businesses to change it, to say that. Like, so that's great that they're saying the right thing, right? But do disabled people notice the difference, right? And like, part of me as a disabled person, not as a sort of professional, because as a professional, probably part of the whitewashing and like sort of helping them do the whitewashing, right? But as a disabled person, I'm like, look, it's more insulting when you say that you're doing the right thing and then you treat me like before. Like part of me preferred it where you're just honest about like not giving a damn. Right.
Yeah, you knew where you stood then, didn't you?
Exactly. Yeah. So that I think is a real challenge everywhere, given like the narrative has kind of really changed. That kind of meaningful participation of disabled people in decision about their lives is still very limited, as I think as we know everywhere. One difference between the UK and other countries, the UK's systems kind of like very like baked in a way, like systems like separating people in schools or later on in life, or disability supports. There's a big infrastructure and it's going to be hard to shift. In other countries, some of that wasn't established before, so there's a chance to kind of go at it from a fresh slate. And like, another issue very close to my heart is then like mobilization, like how disabled people kind of connect with each other, how we act, how we act together, like how we find our peers and our friends, and how we use that to change the world. That's what changed my life in Bangladesh. It's changed the lives of so many disabled people around the world, and it's led to the big gains that we've gotten. But it's a little bit unclear whether, like, how that next generation will come through. Maybe it'll be very different. Maybe it'll be these connections on social media that people make and the voices that people are finding there. But in general, social media mobilization doesn't necessarily link to kind of the, like, long-term connections that social movements need. That's a big sort of generalization. Social media gets a million people on the streets tomorrow, right? But it doesn't sort of do a movement over 5 or 10 years in the same way. I think that's something that is a big question for our community and how we assert ourselves. And it's definitely a question in this country where we are a bit fragmented, and don't necessarily, that there are some very strong groups that you think of, like Inclusion London looks like it's doing really tremendous work, but the folk in Manchester are doing really, really interesting things. But it's quite sort of limited, and it's not in every area, and it's a bit sort of unclear where that comes from. And you just sort of see a drawback on funding and support to those groups. So we're not necessarily going in the right directions on those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. It sounds a sort of a bit of a frustration. It's interesting when you, one of those other trends that you mentioned, in terms of the whitewashing, and almost really people need to be sort of like held to account. But then when movements are largely online and social, and like most things online can quite transient, so you can be held to account 1 week and then that's kind of gone a few weeks later. So yeah, it's interesting to see how that you can actually mobilize something which is sustainable and maintains that presence.
And it's a particular challenge for us in employment, because I think, like, and I hope it's a challenge that Business Disability Forum is working on, because you kind of have to get those corporate agreements and statements, and that is a form of progress, right? That they are saying the right thing. But you also, like, now that we are more established in that, we need to get more accountability, otherwise we're just sort of helping them whitewash. I don't know the best solution to that. I think that we need to be sort of looking at it with more attention and sort of refreshing our techniques for this new position that we're in, right? And if you think about, like, even the phrase disability confident in this country, that, like, sort of saying that to a regular disabled person, they're going to greet that with a lot of skepticism. I've certainly applied for a job that had a, like, disability confident guarantee of an interview for a disabled candidate. Did not get the interview. Yeah, like, I mean, who's going to be surprised by that, right?
And we always frame ourselves at BDF as like the critical friend of business. So we work with them, but we will be honest with you. I always think, and this is just using my own analogy, we're like the friend who'd tell you your label was stuck out the back of your jumper, because you'd rather know than wander around with it stuck out all day. Or yeah, I was going to say your skirt tucked into your knickers, but that's another story entirely. I was going to bring it back to you as well, Peter, just to kind of, I wanted to, because this is about you, this is what we want to talk about, obviously your ideas and theories as well. But I'm thinking, if you could go back and meet kind of a 5 or 10 year old Peter and travel back in time, what would you tell him about how life's going to be, or any sort of words of wisdom you might give to that young Peter? Because I always think that's a fascinating one.
Wow. I've so started being able to kind of see myself, younger self, with a bit more tenderness. Recently, it's easy to be a bit critical, like, especially of the 13-year-old version of oneself. But, like, yeah. Ultimately, I can see, like, they got me where I am. So thanks to the 5 or 10 year old version. I think when I was 9 years old, Lucy, the Disability Discrimination Act was being passed. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea, right? I had no idea that people had fought and protested and changed themselves to buses and done all this campaigning and whatnot to secure a better future for me, right? And that's changed the campaigning they did has changed the potentials in my life. They're the reasons that now that I use an electric wheelchair, I can go around the town, I can go on buses, I can go on trains and shops and restaurants. Guys, come on, do a bit more campaigning. But I think that's a component that was missing from my childhood. I think it's missing from most of our childhoods, and particularly disabled people. But it would be nice for all children to know a little bit more about sort of, oh, there's this disability sort of thing, and like people have done this kind of amazing fights for it. And so I think that's something that would definitely be like great for that younger self to know about it and to see that, like, for the like brilliant achievement it was. I'm not asking that my younger self gets on that identity, but like, or not just seeing disability as this problem or this separate thing that you have, or like this you're doing X, Y, and Z that's different from it, and despite it, I see that like, there's a cool aspect of that some like brilliant people did some stuff that you'd like, you have some rights. Like, I mean, that'd be nice to, that would have been, I think, like a valuable contribution, is something that I really, really encourage people to bring into the lives of the in whatever format, their families and friends and children.
Thank you.
Wonderful. And isn't it great that 5-year-olds now will have the debrief, Peter? By no means a plug, but we're
exactly, yeah, running their first newsletter.
But yeah, somehow time has escaped us, as I kind of knew it would do with you, Peter, because it's always interesting chatting to you. So it'd be great to, if you could just let people know where they can find you online.
Thanks, Smith. We could speak for a long time. The main place is disabilitydebrief.org. And if people put their email addresses, then they'll get the newsletter in their inbox. On Twitter, I'm Desibility, D-E-S-I, Ability and Disdebrief. And I'm also on LinkedIn as well.
Brilliant. Thank you, Peter. It has been wonderful to chat to you. And Lucy, as ever, to be joined with you on screen. We'll see each other again in person one day.
One day, yeah.
But thanks again, Peter. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And we hope you can join us again next time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can find future episodes on major streaming platforms. Search Business Disability Forum or at businessdisabilityforum.org.uk and search podcasts. You can also watch the series on our YouTube channel. Search for Business Disability Forum. Please do share and leave us a rating. Business Disability Forum is the leading business membership organisation in disability inclusion. We work in partnership with business, government and disabled people to remove barriers to inclusion. businessdisabilityforum.org.uk